Welcome to the Business of Property podcast. I'm Simon. I've been investing in property for over 20 years, and if you're an active landlord or planning your next property investment, this podcast provides interesting and useful conversations to help your property journey. If you're willing and able to leave a rating or review in your podcast player of choice, I would really appreciate it. Now, today I am joined by Stuart French, who is the co-owner of Pineapple Group, and he and his business are focused on helping international clients build a UK property portfolio. But his property journey started around 11 years ago with his own personal property investment. And in that particular property, he achieved the holy grail of infinite return on investment, which I think we just have to start on and find out how that was achieved. So, Stuart, what was that first property, and what made you start with that property?
Wow. Well, thanks for having me on, Simon. I think we've been orbiting each other for a number of years now, actually. So it's good to actually get some FaceTime. So thanks for inviting me on.
You're very welcome.
I guess the Holy Grail. I mean, I guess it's worth going back a few years. So I graduated as a structural engineer from University of Southampton, and then immediately went to work offshore for in the seismic industry. I was a navigator for 8 years, and in that time off, I mean, I'd work five weeks on the boat and 5 weeks back in the UK. So I had a lot of time on my hands, and there's only so much going to the pub you can do in that time. So needed something productive to do. So I went out and bought, after doing my research, which we'll talk about in a minute, if you like, I went out and bought an absolute wreck. Now, this thing was in such awful condition. It'd been used as a squat for many years and had been repossessed by the bank. So I was their budding young property investor, went to view the house. You know, no other offers, no one else wanted it. So there was me buying it for £133,000 back in, what was this, 2013, that kind of range. Did all of the work myself, cleared the whole house out, did all of the work myself, got builders in to do boilers and full rewire and everything. And then when I came to refinance it, it was worth £210,000. And, you know, you sat there kind of scratching your head going, what just happened? You know, I'd tracked the data all the way through. I knew that the area was good. I knew that there was uplift there. But then when you actually get the kind of check through the post, you're scratching your head thinking, okay, so something's just happened here. And then from there, I was just in love with investing. I love finding deals. I love refurbishing them. I love absolutely everything about it. So that was my entrance into real estate, was with a big win. And then I built my portfolio out from there while I was working offshore, and then made the jump into setting up my own business, which I own with Greg.
I'm intrigued. You said you fell in love with property from that deal and that property. But why did you actually buy property in the first place, especially if you weren't in love with property yet at that point? Did you have an inkling that property would be good, or was it just, well, I've got to do something and sort of put a pin in a map kind of thing?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think I always, property is one of those really intriguing things. I think once it grabs your attention, it's really hard to look away. I don't know whether people have the same thing with, I don't know, classic cars or stocks or, you know, hobbies, but it just became something to me that just kind of fixed my attention. And having done an engineering degree, I thought that I was Mr. Builder, and it just, everything kind of came in lockstep, really. After that first property, though, that's when I knew, okay, there's something here, and this is the way out of, I mean, I loved my job at the time. I really loved it. It was a good career. Got to travel the world. But yeah, as soon as you get that property bug, something just changes inside you. And I really wanted to own my own business and do it full time so that I could do it more. And that's kind of how I got into it, really. But as for knowing beforehand, I think there was always an inkling there. I think it's something that always kind of excited me about taking something. Don't know if you're the same, but when you're walking down a street in an area that you've never been to, and you're kind of spotting all the houses that are a little bit dilapidated, or you think maybe you could do something like that, or you're kind of thinking there's a lot of flats in this area, a lot of people are converting their houses to flats, and you kind of pick them out. I mean, do you do the same thing?
There's a property that's, I don't know, a few roads away from where I live.
Yeah.
And I drive past it fairly often. And it has been, I've lived in this area for over 10 years, crikey, over 15 years. Crikey, anyway, let's not dwell on that.
Flies, doesn't it?
and this property has been the same since the first time I saw it. And that state is that it is all boarded up and behind a sort of builder's fence kind of thing. And every time I go past it, I think, surely you could do something with that property.
Yeah.
and just sort of bring it back to life. And,
that's it.
And yes, so it's, yes, I do share that sort of interest in watching the properties as you go past them, and just sort of feeling that there should be more to do with some of these, as you sort of see them looking like they're falling down a bit or whatever else. Yeah.
I think that's it. I think that is the kind of what you've described there, is the feeling of the property bug, where you can be doing something as simple as taking the dog for a walk in a familiar area, and it's that house, and you're always looking and looking and looking. And then I had had a similar situation during COVID. Actually, there was where we walk our dog, there's a park, and it's kind of near some farmland, and there's a farm, and next to the farm, outside the curtailage of the farm, there was this really dilapidated building. And when I was a kid, it got struck by lightning and sort of burnt down, and it was just the same ever since. And we'd always talk about that little house and kind of like, wonder why no one's done anything with it yet, those kind of discussions. And then during COVID, we didn't go back to that park for a long time. And then afterwards, we went back, and it was completely rebuilt as a brand new house with a little garden and stuff. And you kind of think, well done.
Yeah, wish fantastic. It was me. Somebody actually did it.
Yeah. Then the jealousy kicks in, and you're kind of like, maybe I should have done something. Maybe I should have sent them a letter. But that's kind of what we do now, really, is send out a lot of letters, knock on a lot of doors. Because, I mean, London's rife for it, really. I mean, you walk down any street in London and there's something. There's always something, with the curtains drawn or the newspaper in the window, and that that's just been empty for years. So we
should talk a bit about how you find properties.
Yeah.
But I think because at the moment you're finding lots of properties for lots of people, but I think perhaps if we just start with that first property, how did you find that one? And also, actually, were you looking for an investment property, or were you looking for somewhere to live, or?
Yeah. Wow. I mean, this is going back into like the caveman days of Rightmove. So actually what I did is I was looking for, I didn't even know the word yield at the time. I'd call it ratio, because like engineering background, everything's in a ratio. So I had back in the days when, the split screen on Windows had come out. So you could have like a screen here and a screen there. So I kind of had one for sale, one for rent, and I'd kind of move them around together and kind of all over the southeast, just looking at what properties cost and kind of writing it down and what the rent cost and working out this ratio. And then I kind of found this area in southeast England, Medway, and that was an area that seemed to have this good ratio. So I started looking there, and then what I started doing is reading the local plans and finding out what's actually going on in these.
You really know how to have an exciting evening, don't you? Breaking out those local plans.
I know. What am I like? But what I've found is that in the next year, they just started building the terminal, one of the terminals for High Speed 1. So a £27 million train station in Rochester, high speed links into London, and then also that line actually ends up going onto the continent as well. So it's like, this is a big thing. And they had big plans to develop all of the old docks and stuff like that. So I was like, there's big investment going in here and property prices were quite cheap. So I kind of thought, well, I could buy something here. So I bought what I could afford and something that I could add value to. And then from there, it was, okay, that was the kind of proof of concept. And then from there, it was, okay, this area is good now. So I started buying more in that area, did more buy-to-lets, HMOs. So it was almost like an archaic version of what's available now. You know, you can do, that can do all of the number crunching for you very, very quickly, something like Patma. But before it was completely manual, just a process of finding these areas, reading the plans, looking at the rents manually. That's kind of how it started.
Yeah, as you say, long time ago, doing it the hard way.
but
getting the results. So I do want to talk more about how you're finding properties now. But just to finish up that first property, I understand from our pre-recording chat that you have over time enjoyed that property and the income, the infinite income from it. Not quite sure that's quite the right meaning, but anyway, but in the end, you shunned that infinite ROI and sold it.
Yeah.
Why did you sell it and what did you get for it and were you happy with that decision?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it was my first one, so it's always like an emotional thing, isn't it, to kind of sell your first property. It was bought at a time, I bought it in my own name. I started building my portfolio in my own name. And then when they changed the tax laws, it just became this, you know, you're looking into the future and yeah, it's great to get the income every single month, but you know, the capital gains, and if I just started a business at the time. So if ever you're taking a salary out of the business, then you become a high rate taxpayer already. So it kind of made sense to me financially to sell the property or sell some properties, get that, take the equity out, and then basically build up again, but with a better structure. And that was something that I think even my parents, who are investors as well, they're still kind of, at the time, they were like, why would you do that? But it just made sense to me at the time. Means I could focus on my business. I mean, we still buy properties through the company, which is great. So I still get action in the market for myself as well as for our clients. But yeah, it was something about owning it in my own name and becoming you wake up on the first of the month and you're a high rate taxpayer already. And especially seeing as, you know, I sold when interest rates were still quite low. So now it would be, you'd wake up on the first of the month, you're a higher rate taxpayer, and you've probably made £100 from your property. So it kind of made sense to me at the time. It gave me a lot of flexibility. I was still in my early 30s when I sold it, so I still had a little bit of time. So it was almost like a backing myself to build it back up in a more professional way, which I think is, it was a risk, but it's one that I think is paying dividends now. It gives me a lot more flexibility, and it's also nice to have a bank balance that's full of cash after you've sold a property. So
I think you say if you're a high rate taxpayer and and got a mortgage on a property, you might be only £100 a month, whatever, after you've worried about the tax, but if you're not careful, you can actually be negative, as in you can actually after tax be paying to have a property, which is a bad situation for anyone.
Yeah, so, it needs to work for you. The portfolio needs to be there to, you know, there's a bad habit in at least a lot of the people that I speak to that are UK based investors, or they're investors from overseas, but they already have their UK portfolios, and you kind of run through the numbers and you're asking them about their portfolio and they're not making that much money and they haven't bought in a particularly strong capital growth area. And they're still saying that it's, you know, this is for my retirement. But you're kind of thinking, you're delaying all of your gratification in order to have this, you know, capital growth over time, but you own all the properties in your own name, so you're going to get decimated with capital gains anyway, and you're not making an income for it, from it, and you're paying a managing agent 12% to do this. Like, where is your win? where is your win? And almost kind of having to deconstruct that in someone's mind and ask a couple of probing questions, and they kind of sometimes midway through the call, they're kind of like, yeah, not sure why I've done these things. I was told that property was a really good thing, so I've bought lots of it, but it's not making it, not making any money. So that's what we do, is we try, one of the things that we do is try to kind of help people make their portfolios a little bit more efficient as a first step.
Yeah, and even just to understand their portfolios a bit more, from the sounds of it.
Yeah.
So I've teased this a couple of times, so we should really start talking about how and why you choose properties these days. First of all, I think if we start with investment areas, which can be a bit contentious. Some people always want to hunt for yield or hunt for capital growth or whatever, and they'll invest wherever. Other people, like me included, want the sort of self-management and that side of it, and hence will limit themselves to being local. Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that you've got three, maybe four sort of specific areas you're sort of focusing your search for properties in. Why have you landed on those particular areas? And indeed, where are they? Where should everyone be looking for property?
Well, it's another good question. So I think every single person is different. So every single investor is different and their needs are different. I see the true advantage of real estate investing to be the capital growth element. So you might look at an area like Manchester and you might think 6 or 7%. 6 or 7% yields, it's not good enough. I want to replace my income, so I need higher cash flow. So you might go and buy in Glasgow or somewhere like that, where you can get 10, 11, 12, 13% off the shelf. But when you look at the capital growth in those areas, not specifically Glasgow, but high cash flow areas tend to have lower capital growth, which to me is, it's not really getting the true benefit of real estate. So we look for capital growth areas that are also going to give you cash flow. You know, you buy the property, refurbish it to add the value, refinance, and then keep your money moving. So London has typically been a good area. I think right now, specifically now, it's, if you've got cash, it's an incredible area to buy, because not a lot of people have, you know, £1 million just lying around to buy cash. But if you're an investor and you're looking to build a portfolio, you might do. So if you're a vendor and you're sat on the market right now, even on market, there's big discounts available, because if you've got a whacking great mortgage on a huge house in London and you're struggling, you're going to need to get out from underneath that quite quickly. I mean, people lose their jobs, people get divorced, all of these things, none of them stop because of interest rates are high. So there's always a market. So we do a lot of on-market stuff because it's a bigger market. And, you know, statistically speaking, it's going to have the most expensive and the least expensive because it's a bigger market. But in terms of we off-market as well, you know, send a lot of letters, probate. Probate's a really interesting one, actually, because takes a lot of effort and a lot of time to secure probate properties, and they always come with lots of baggage. So family situation, might be 4 or 5 people that need to agree to a sale, and you know, when you approach them, they might say yes, and then a few months later they've been approached by Hunters, and they've been approached by Savills, and they've been approached by Foxtons, and all of a sudden you get one person that's thinking, well, maybe we can just put it on the market. So they're really volatile, probate properties. Mm-hmm. And then what tends to happen is you lose the sale to someone like Foxtons, who then list it on Rightmove as a probate property. So on market, off market, Manchester's always been a good area for us. I mean, the rhetoric of property investors is that property prices double every 10 years, which means that it needs 7.2% per annum. And then you look at Manchester and it's like 50% over the last 5 years, sometimes 60%. Things are starting to dip a little bit now. So when you track that back, it's more like 45%. But those are good capital growth areas. Manchester, London. And then if you're looking for a little bit more cash flow, then you can do Liverpool as well. But it comes with its own quirks. Also, the southeast of England is where we started. So all of our HMOs are in the southeast of England. Our own portfolio is there that we manage through Pineapple Living, because that is an excellent capital growth market. I mean, year on year, things just seem to be getting more and more and more expensive. Rents are really good. Lots of hospitals around there. So there's lots of flow for people, for lots of people coming in and out of Kent, which is great for HMOs. So yeah, Kent, Manchester, London.
With the mention of hospitals and people coming in and out, I'm not quite sure where you were going with that, but hopefully not too many dying and being born. You've got a while before they be customers. But
no, nurses make good tenants.
So there's lots of different areas there, and they're very geographically dispersed.
Yeah,
and I think you're actually based in the southeast, so yeah. The ones in the southeast are probably a bit easier for you to get around to and have a look at and things like that. Mm-hmm. But how do you go about narrowing an area down to an investment property?
It's a good question, and I think this is what separates a homeowner investor to a committed professional investor. So lots of times, and I'm sure that you've had this as well, you'll be speaking to someone that's, you know, they're looking to build an investment property, but it has to be within 20 minutes of where my parents live because they're going to manage it. And it doesn't seem to me like a flexible strategy at all, because you're backed into a corner, really, in terms of you're tied to how the market's doing in that area. So I think it's better to look at countrywide data, and we're a data-led company. So we look at salaries across all of the counties in the UK. And we look at exactly what people are earning, where the investment's going, absolutely, like all of the data. And then the salary is a really interesting one actually as well, because if you actually look at the average salary of an area, and then you take, say, 30% of that and say, this is what people are typically, 30-35%, this is what people are typically willing to spend on accommodation. And then you compare that to the rent that's the market rent for the properties that are actually online. More often than not, you'll see that the price is wrong. It's typically too low. So if you can find an area where the market rent is lower than what people earn, that kind of 30-35%. And then you can provide a really good product to those people, really well managed, really well refurbished with like good fixtures and fittings, not landlord special. It's got to be really, really nice. Then it's likely that there's a market for people that are still looking to rent because either they can't afford to buy or their personal situation says that they don't want to buy. But you can provide a really good product to that person. So looking at the data nationwide, you can see where these kind of areas are. And then it's more about logistics. So we have a couple of build teams that we use. And if we've got projects in Manchester, we'll move them to Manchester to do those projects. And then if we've got projects in Southeast London, we'll keep them down here. So the logistics are a little bit more difficult. But I think you just got to be data led. You got to find where those areas are by looking at the data.
So, how would you define a good individual property? So, as in, do you analyze expected ROI? But I'm sure you must. And then what is good or bad in that? But then also, do you look for some of the slightly crazy things I've started looking at is whether it's got a south-facing roof to potentially put solar panels on. I mean, I have no idea if you're looking at that kind of thing or not, but what are those sort of details that you look for in properties that you're considering?
Yeah, it's another good question. So admittedly, I haven't looked at whether it has a south-facing roof before. That's maybe a level of detail that I'm not up to your standards, Simon. But
I think what you mean is you're not quite as quirky in your your properties as I am.
No, but I guess ensconced inside that is the question of energy prices. And we all know, I mean, it's less of an issue now, but a few years ago, I mean, was it a few years ago? 18 months ago, maybe a year ago?
Yeah.
Property prices, energy prices were massive. So people couldn't turn their heating on and things like that. So if you can, I think what you're alluding to there is how many good elements can you augment into your property to make it as attractive as possible? You know, I mean, but the game doesn't really change that much. It's transport links, schools. If you're buying a 3-bed, you want to be closer to secondary schools. And if you're buying 2 beds, you need to be aware that your tenants are going to stay for less time. So you're probably going to be putting more maintenance into the property. But then also the other side of the coin there is that if you have people staying in, if you have like a 3-bed house and you have a family stays there for 6 or 7 years, it's likely that by the time that they leave, then the rent that they're paying isn't going to be the market price. So it's going to slowly kind of reduce. Whereas if you have a 2-bed, then the frequency is a lot more, you know, they have another baby, then, you know, they need to move to a bigger house, something like that. But to answer your question, what do we look for? So it needs to be good transport links and good schools. In terms of refurbishment works and stuff, the things that stick in my mind are, it almost seems like with, say, an issue like damp, people see like condensation on the wall, like black mold or something, and it looks really striking. Like you walk into a house and there's black mold or something on the walls. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the house has a big problem. It could just mean that it's a rental property and they never open the windows. And more often than not, it is actually fine. Victorian terrace houses, as I'm sure you know, are a difficult beast when it comes to things like that. But trying to avoid buying houses with big problems, one of the biggest ones actually that's kind of popped into my mind is non-standard construction. Now, when I started, I didn't know that this was even a thing. So non-standard construction would be you've got a house with a steel frame, or it's been made with poured concrete in the same way that they do in Europe. It's very standard way to build in Europe. But you go up into the loft and there's like a metal roof. It's got like, rather than using timber joists and stuff, it's a steel roof. So you buy the property because it's lower priced than the rest of the properties around it, and you think you've got a great deal, and then you go to NatWest to get your mortgage and they just flat say no, and it's just a waste of time and a waste of money if you go into the purchase not knowing that it's non-standard construction. I mean, typically they'll tell you, but sometimes they won't. So knowing those things first just causes so many issues later down the line.
So I know your focus in properties is HMOs rather than single lets. I don't think you're exclusively HMO, but I think that is your focus. And with that, you do a lot of refurbishments, as in you generally purchase properties that are not HMOs already and you turn them into HMOs.
Yeah.
Do you look for properties that are actually sort of run down and dilapidated and need a sort of major refurbishment? Or do you look more for properties that are okay, but just need converting into being an HMO?
Yeah, good. So I think the rule of thumb that we found at the very least is the more that you're going to change the building, the worse state that you want to buy it in. So if you're taking a property that's, you know, a three-story Victorian terrace property and you're going to turn it into a HMO, 7, 8, 9 beds, something like that. If you're buying a really, really good quality family home from a vendor that's, you know, they're selling their family home and they've done maybe even done a little bit of work to it before selling it, it's going to be priced way too high for the works that you want to do to it, because essentially it's going to be a back to brick renovation with plumbing running everywhere for en suites and brand new electrics, most likely, all of those things. Even like the properties that we're doing now have a small plant room in them with the boiler and the cylinder and all these kind of things. So you want to be buying these as low price as possible, because you're going to be stripping out all of those things that the homeowner is attaching value to in the sale. You're going to be stripping them all out. So you want to buy that as cheaply as possible so that you can turn it into your 7, 8, 9 beds HMO. And the strategy there would be to buy as cheaply as possible, uplift the value, and then exit onto a commercial mortgage. And that's kind of where you want to go with it. But the builds, especially in the southeast of England, they're really expensive. So for the numbers to work, which they do, they're very, very healthy. Yeah, you want to be buying that as cheaply as possible, or buying something commercial and turning it into HMO. That's another good one.
So when you say buying as cheaply as possible, presumably you mean in as worst condition as possible.
Yes, in as worst condition as possible, because you're going to be stripping everything out. So it's good because you get to almost start from scratch. The worst thing that you can have with a multi-let property is, say, like plumbing issues, something like that, because you've cut a corner. You want to make sure that everything is right, because tenants move a lot more frequently. Typically there's a little bit more choice on the market. They have less ties because, you know, it's just a single person. So if there's problems with the property, then they can just move somewhere else. So you want to make sure that quality of product is as high as possible. And the way to do that is to make sure that as many things as possible are for within your budget are new.
Yeah.
Do you follow that kind of system? How do you do yours, Simon?
So I don't do HMOs, so I'm that makes life a bit easier to start with. but on the buy-to-let front, I tend to do sort of light refurbishment. So I try to find properties that can sort of be improved a bit soon after purchase. My most recent purchase was accidentally slightly more of a refurbishment than I anticipated going into it. So that was the most major sort of refurb I've done so far. And it's worked okay. It's renting very well, but it was a lot more expensive to do than I had anticipated. And I didn't time the purchase terribly well, but these things happen. It's certainly the property currently is worth less than I paid for it, plus the refurb. But in time, it'll work out.
I can imagine it's going to be a long-term investment. So as with all things, if your strategy is buy and hold, it's okay. Because you're not looking. If it was a flip, then maybe
I'd be in trouble.
maybe you're in trouble. But if you've put a level of work into it, that's going to pay you dividends later. Plus, I mean, we were talking about tax before the camera started rolling, but it's deductible. So
yeah, indeed. I mean, it'll work itself out in the long term. It is a long term investment. It's not intended to be, as you say, a flip or anything like that, thankfully. Good. And so I'm not too worried, but I think it does show that you do have to be quite careful about what you're expecting to spend on a property when you purchase it. And given that you're going into your properties with the expectation that you're going to do a full refurb, sort of back to brick style, then at least you'll know that expense upfront, and you can plan for that. And if you can buy properties that are sort of in a condition that kind of needs that anyway, then hopefully they'll fit the pricing and fit the investment plan, so you can get that uplift straight away. Mm-hmm. I know sort of unicorn properties are rare, and you did achieve it very early on. Do you still see unicorn properties come through your business at the moment?
Yeah.
Or how often do you see them then? Is it rare, or do you manage to achieve that a bit more often?
So they exist from my, this is just my from my experience. They exist at the fringes. So they exist with the very low end. So it doesn't necessarily mean that the property price itself is low, but the say auctions. If you were to buy an auction, then it's more likely that you're going to be able to recycle all of the money. And then at the very upper end, so if you're doing large HMOs, things like that, and exiting onto commercial product, the likelihood that you're going to be able to get all of your money out is a lot higher than if you're in the middle, if you're doing anything from a 6-bed HMO to a kind of off-the-shelf buy-to-let, even if you get a good deal, because the uplift has to be so much, it's unlikely that you're going to get all of your money out unless you're operating at those fringes. So if you're buying with cash, like, for sure auctions is a good way to go, but that comes with its own downsides. I mean, we had a property recently that it was just an on-market property for a really good price, negotiated the sale, everything was going through, but then we figured out that the person that was staying at the property was a tenant that knew the vendor, and they didn't want to leave. And then when the lenders said, you know, you kind of go through it and you're answering all the questions, is there something in the property? It's like, yeah, there's a tenant in the property. They want to see all the documentation. The documentation wasn't set up properly. So they had the AST, but they hadn't had the how to rent guide. They hadn't had certs and all these kind of things. So the lenders aren't going to lend.
Yeah, because you can't give notice to them in that situation. So, yeah.
Exactly. So essentially that property was, we withdrew from the sale, but that property is only going to be sold to an investor, and it's not likely that they're going to get the price that they want for it. So if they do want to sell, it's likely that it's going to end up in auction. And those are the types of properties that are really, you just wish you hadn't. Because they're difficult, but they're not difficult because of the actual mechanics of the property investing. It's more the legal issues and all of those kind of things. So the unicorn properties do still exist for sure. Maybe not so much on market. Probate for sure. If you have the nerve to sit through the kind of volatility of a few months worth of will they, won't they, will they, won't they. But for sure they still exist, but a lot less than in when I started, at least.
Yeah, well, you did start on a high from that point of view.
I know.
Hard to maintain that forever.
I know. It's kind of like winning your first hand of poker, and then something seeds inside your brain and says that this is a good idea, and then 12 years later, you're still at the table.
Yeah, you're still waiting to win your next hand of poker. Yeah.
That's right.
So we've run a bit long today, but there is one more thing that I'm curious about that I'd like to ask you before we finish up. And that's that your business, Pineapple Group, is focusing on helping international people and international investors. Yeah. How did you arrive at that focus rather than just looking for people in the UK that you could go out and meet at networking events? Why make it harder and try and find people in other countries?
I know, maybe someone should have asked me that question when we started, Simon. But ultimately, because we're a data-led company and we can invest anywhere, we needed to pick up the skills to do things remotely ourselves. So we couldn't just be traveling up to Manchester, Liverpool, all of these places all of the time, because it's just not the way to do it. So in order to be successful in what we were doing for ourselves, we needed to figure out how to do things remotely. So whether it's using survey companies to do viewings for us, or just having the right people in the right places at the right time, that was something that we solved. And then we kind of thought, well, people that are based overseas need to have exactly that. They need to be able to access the whole of the UK from where they are without moving. And the team that we built and the system that we built to invest remotely for ourselves had like a hand in glove application for people that are outside the UK. And they have from what we've experienced over the last few years, they have a particular set of requirements that they're going to need. You know, they need to know how to set up a UK limited company. And they also need someone that is not just about buying the property, because I'm sure they could just go and find an agent that could help them buy a property. But it's more the process of setting up a UK limited company, picking a strategy that's actually going to work for them in the right area, and then picking a portfolio of properties to purchase, and then having someone to manage them. So it was that whole pipeline of things that we'd already solved for ourselves that had the application for overseas buyers. And it's kind of, yeah, it's kind of been like I said, a hand in glove type situation where when we speak to new clients or new prospects and we kind of explain the service and exactly what it involves, they're like, yeah, that solves all of the problems that I have. How do we start?
Cool. So if people are curious and would like to get in touch with you and find out more about the services you can offer, whether you're sourcing Sure. or property management or even just having a chat about their property strategy and things, what's the best way for them to reach out and get in touch with you?
Yeah, so I think the first step really is to discover for yourself as an investor whether investing in the UK is going to be right for you. And we've taken great pains to make books, courses, videos explaining exactly how the process of investing in the UK works from overseas, so that you can see whether it's right for you, because it might not be. You could invest in stocks, you could do something different, but if it turns out that it is the right thing for you, go to our website, pineapple-group.co.uk. There's some free resources on there. We've got a newsletter that we give lots of market information, lots of investing strategies and tactics, and kind of show you how everything works. And then there's an opportunity to book in some time in our calendar and speak to us in a similar way that we've spoken to you today. It'd be a very relaxed call. We'll just kind of guide you through the process and see if it works for you. Or if you don't want to go to a website and you're on social media, if you go to our Instagram, pineapplegroup.co.uk, or our YouTube channel, which is the same name.
Cool, fantastic. And all of those links will be in the show notes as well, so you don't have to remember them all right now. You can check the show notes and find Stuart there. So it just remains for me to say thank you very much, Stuart, for joining me today and
for
sharing your knowledge and experience. And to everyone listening, thank you very much. I hope you've enjoyed this conversation as much as I have. And I will be back again next week.